Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson, Mike Cosentino.
Here he is.
Sitting across from me in the flesh. We have a guest with us today, right, Mike?
We do.
Winona Benally Baldinegro. She's running for Congress in the 1st District of Arizona, which is our district.
Congressional District 1.
Congressional District 1.
She's running against Ann Kirkpatrick. For the primary is where we are, just in case, you know, to keep your election stuff straight here, folks. We're still running up to the primary. I know it seems like an election never stops, and it's a 24/7 thing, but we are just running up to the primary, and Winona is in that race.
So, Winona, tell us a little bit about your background. You have a really, really interesting background. You have a fantastic number of achievements.
Certainly. Well, again, my name is Winona Benally Baldinegro. Running in the Democratic race for Congressional District 1. And I'm originally from Kienta, which is located right outside of Minumid Valley. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation, grew up my entire life there on the Navajo Reservation, and, spent a great deal of time, learning a lot about growing up in a small town like Kienta, you really learn the work ethic that it takes to certainly survive in those small towns, and really you become humble about the families that are there and, what it takes for us to be successful and to go on and do the things that we've done. That we do in our lives, and certainly my story fits in that category.
I've been to Kienta. It's a pretty concentrated little group up there.
There certainly is. At the time that I grew up in Kienta, I believe there was anywhere between 1,000 to 5,000 people. I know that's a little large in terms of
But if you've been to the reservation, you know how that works. There's Kienta, and then there's all the stuff around Kienta.
Exactly, and there's nothing in between.
That's right.
Yes, that's also true.
And so it's very remote. I grew up in a single-parent household. My mother had raised, three boys, and including me, I should say. And, she just had this great, wonderful work ethic, and also really was motivated to provide a better life for certainly my family, but for the people in the community, and that's why she became a teacher.
And you went to Arizona State, got your BA there.
Yes.
And then you went to Harvard, and you got your law degree there. And you got your, what is the degree in public
policy?
Policy, yeah.
The degree is a master in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government there at Harvard. But leading up to that, I think it's, really important for me to share how I got there.
Tell us.
Certainly is, coming from a small town like Kienta, I grew up in a poor household. My mother only made $24,000 a year. We had to survive on that salary. She only had a high school education at the time she became a single parent. So it was tough early on when we were growing up. But my mother persevered. She kept at it and had actually gone on to earn her bachelor's degree as well as her master's degree in education. And, I was very inspired by that. She certainly became the role model for me and taught me very early on that if I can do this, you certainly can. And I did. I went on to Arizona State University, where I graduated summa cum laude. Yeah. I also graduated from the Barrett Honors College and stayed in Phoenix and took a job with a nonprofit called the Intertribal Council of Arizona. And they work with all of the 21 tribes here in Arizona, and they work on they assist tribes on a vast array of public policy areas, everything from education, healthcare, transportation, economic, community development, just everything. And so I started out as a healthcare policy analyst working at ITCA and stayed for about 2 years. And during that time, actually was very fortunate to expand my horizons and worked on education, housing, and transportation, renewable energy, and was very inspired by the work that I did in the public sector.
As you've seen, then, you're probably really well situated, seeing tribal structure, tribal politics from inside and from out. I mean, you spent all that time in the East going to school. You got some distance. You can look back at it and reflect on it. So give us some insights into, you know, a lot of us have, what is tribal politics about? How does it play in state politics, especially in the race that you're in?
Yes. Well, what a lot of folks don't know about Indian tribes is that Indian tribes are governments. They have a governmental structure in place. And we have a direct government-to-government relationship with the federal government. And so it is crucially important for our members of Congress to understand this relationship because it forms the foundation by which we provide the services and programs on our reservations.
Does the federal government try to be a little more patriarchal, for want of a better term?
It can be at times.
Yeah.
You know, it depends by presidential administration.
I see.
But for the most part, there is a recognition that there is a relationship there that recognizes that we're dealing with you as another government within
the United
States.
So when people refer to the Navajo Nation, they mean that in a strong sense.
Yes, they certainly do.
It is a sense of nation, right?
And when we talk about governments, we talk about also having authority and jurisdiction over, you know, a certain land base, and that's what makes us a government. And so when it comes to the state, we are treated very much like a state government, and we function. Navajo Nation by itself has a bureaucracy that's akin to what you find on the East Coast, you know, with Rhode Island, Delaware, the smaller states. I mean, we function very much like a state government.
Yeah, Window Rock can be just like any other government capital. Navajos, like I said, how many are there, and what's their voting record? They're a force in Arizona that's, like you are starting to explain, that a few of us understand.
You know, I haven't looked at the numbers lately. We just went through redistricting.
Oh, right.
And so that's, you know, the census taken every 10 years. So I don't know what the numbers are lately. And we tend to also measure the membership that lives on reservation and the membership that lives off reservation.
Right.
And what we know is that there are a growing number of, and this just isn't the Navajo Nation, but large number of Navajos are moving off reservation.
Right.
Were you ever tempted? I mean, you're going to Harvard Law School, which frankly is a ticket to sort of print money. Were you ever tempted? No, yeah, okay. But were you ever tempted not to come back because there was so much opportunity on the East Coast, yet you came back, you put your shoulder to the wheel, so to speak, right away?
No, there was never a thought in my mind about pursuing, you know, a job in some big law firm on the East Coast or for even a corporation. You know, one story that I always like to share with folks to really give them a good sense of how important it is that we get a representative in office who identifies with the needs of those rural towns in the district has to do with what's happened in my own lifetime. You know, as I'd mentioned before, on the reservation, our healthcare facilities are funded by the federal government directly by Congress. And so when Congress makes votes on the appropriations bills every year, there are provisions in those bills that set aside funding for clinics in my hometown, Lycanta. And a couple years ago, when Congress kept postponing the vote on the appropriations bill, It actually affected, it directly affected the health clinic in my town.
Excellent.
Where the, what ended up happening is the healthcare administrators taped a note to the door saying that the emergency room is closed due to budget cuts.
Wow. Yeah. So when they're playing politics with appropriations, it has real impact on people's lives.
It has direct real-world impacts on those of us who live in these communities and rely on those programs and services.
I had a friend from Pine Ridge up in South Dakota, lived on the reservation up there. She had to wait 2 years to get a pair of glasses. I don't think that's all that uncommon, is it?
It's not uncommon, unfortunately. And, you know, and that's why the Navajo Nation and other tribes across the country are really looking for opportunities to, you know, launch economic development programs. You know, we are very much concerned about promoting small business owners, about building the economy on our reservations.
And you're going to need some water to do that. One of the things I want to talk about today is the Little Colorado flare-up that just happened in the last couple of weeks.
There's a saying, and if you're coming on to our show from the internet, there's a saying in Arizona, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting.
And <That's>
we're all, in Arizona, we're always fighting about water.
I love the down at SRP, if you walk into the lobby of the Salt River Project down in Phoenix, there is a huge portrait of a man on horseback. He and the horse are standing at head gate of an irrigation ditch, and he's got a gun across his lap. I mean, and he's looking out over this valley. I mean, to me, that says it all about Arizona water. I mean, you've got it. It's certainly worth shooting over. It's you're going to protect it, that kind of thing.
They certainly think they own the water in the Verde River here.
SRP issues. But let's talk about Senators Kyle and McCain have ushered in a bill to do some things with the Little Colorado River Basin water, and some people see it as a preservation of the water and developing the water that right now is undeveloped. Other people see it as stealing the Navajos and the reservation water. What's going on?
Well, the bill that you're referring to is called the Navajo Hopi Little Colorado River Water Settlement Bill. And there's actually two bills. The one most people are familiar with is the one that's been introduced in the Senate.
Right.
Which is S-2109, but there's also a companion bill that's going through the House called H.R. 4067, I believe. And they have identical language. And there's two parts to this bill. The overall goal of the bill is to settle claims to the Little Colorado River by the Navajo Nation and the Hopi Tribe. And the first part of this bill sets out, it allocates $350 million mm-hmm. for three groundwater delivery projects. For two of those projects will go to the Navajo Nation, and one will go to one of the communities on Hopi.
Well, see, that's it's one thing to have water, it's another thing to be able to get at it, and right now they can't get at it.
They can't.
Are they going to appropriate the money to actually get the water to the reservations? That's
not in the bill. That would have to come in a separate appropriation bill, and that's where it's problematic as well. You know, that's where the concern has been expressed by many members of the Navajo and Navajo Nation and Hopi Tribe is that, look, we've been through this process before. This goes back to my story about appropriating money for Indian healthcare services. You know, we have to rely on Congress, and if they want to take this and, you know, treat it like a political football, I mean, that really puts us at a disadvantage, and certainly there really is no guarantee. There is no, we can't plan for the future. You know, what the bill essentially does is says, look, we will, this is how much these groundwater projects will cost, and this is where we're going to build the water projects. These are the communities that it will go to. But in order to get the money, you're going to have to go back to Congress. And so that's been problematic for a lot of the folks who've expressed concern. The other more problematic part of this bill is in the second part of it. And what the second part of the bill does is it actually renews the land leases for the Navajo Generating Station.
I see.
And for most folks who don't know, the Navajo Generating Station is the coal-fired power plant located in Page, Arizona, or outside of Page, Arizona. Yeah. The Navajo Generating Station takes pristine water from the aquifers under our reservation. That's what they use the water to, what they call slurry, the coal, to the generating the power plant, and that's what provides electricity. And this is where the whole issue of water comes in, the Colorado River cap. A lot of folks don't know where their drinking water comes from, the source of their drinking water.
Okay.
And I was just down in Tucson, and I asked them, do you all know where your water comes from? And a lot of people don't know. Well, a large percentage of the water, the drinking water that folks get in Tucson, in Phoenix, comes from the big Colorado River, and it comes down the Central Arizona Project Canal. Well, it takes electricity. It takes energy to get the water from northern Arizona to southern Arizona. Well, Navajo Generating Station produces electricity to get that water. Navajo Generating Station relies on coal taken from Black Mesa coal mine located on the reservation. So this is an issue that affects all of us across Arizona.
But it seems quid pro quo. You're talking about economic development, and you got water in the ground. The government, the federal government's willing to get it out and develop that, which would then foster economic development on the reservation. It seems, I don't know, where's the downside here, other than renewing the lease for those people that are anti-coal, and that, the whole environmental impact of that. I guess I could see their resistance to the bill. Is there anything else in the bill? Is there something that, is somebody else getting water rights away from the Navajo and Hopi?
Well, you know, what it really comes down to, it's not specific language in the bill per se, but it's all these agreements that have been entered into outside of the bill itself. And, you know, going back again to the Navajo Generating Station and to the Peabody coal mine, you know, they're taking our source of drinking water mm-hmm. on the reservation. And, you know, keep in mind that the bill only provides for three communities. There's over 110 communities on the Navajo reservation. Only three of those communities are going to get drinking water.
Well, I'm playing devil's advocate here. I see that as seed, as starting. You know, it's right now. I mean, I've been on the reservation. You're hauling water. You know, you got a cistern. You're driving down. You're going down to Silver Saddle or Winona, Arizona, just on the edge of the res, and you're filling up and you're hauling that water out there. It seems like a little bit of water development, of tapping into those aquifers, would be way superior to that.
But I think the underlying premise of what you're saying is that you're presuming that there's going to be an unlimited source of water to go around.
Yeah, that's right.
There is not. We have a huge water shortage problem in Arizona and across the Southwest, across the West Coast. And it goes back exactly to, you know, what you had said earlier. We fight over water, and that's going to be the next biggest political fight in Arizona is over water. We are running out of it.
And between Arizona and Colorado and California and Nevada over who gets how much water, because folks, when they divided up the water from the Colorado River, they did it after a period of very, very high rains for years. So they divided up a quantity of water that has never existed since they divided it up, because it was the top of a chart rather than a midway or
down
at the
bottom. Yeah, that was the other question. You know, I crossed the Little Colorado there at Cameron, you know, and I'm looking over the bridge, and you know, in April I see water, and I've been to Grand Falls, out there by Loop on the Navajo Res, when it was running, and I've been in the loop when it wasn't running, and it's just a couple of mud cliffs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they talk about 165,000 acre feet of water in the Little Colorado, I'm saying, yeah, maybe in March, but other than that, so, but I also understand we're talking about the basin and the aquifers and that kind of thing.
Yes,
so, so yeah, it's not going
to
be a simple.
So what can you take to the rest of the CD from all this experience and that you've had and all this idealism? I mean, coming back and when you could have made, you know, if I go back to it, 10 times as much money back east, you came back for idealistic reasons because you wanted to help, right? Because you wanted to do something here. What do you want to do if you're elected to Congress from the first CD?
Well, a lot of folks in the district have been hurt by the economy, and certainly more so than others. And the biggest priority for people across the district is jobs, you know, and good paying jobs. You know, one thing that a lot of people who are, you know, may not have lived in Arizona for a very long time know is that, you know, Arizona, particularly in the rural parts of this district, mining was the big job creator. But what we've learned over generations of our families, and this is where my husband's background comes in, you know, he comes from the southern part of the district. He comes from a mining family. They lived in a place called Hayden, located there in the Copper Basin, and his grandfather was a steelworker. You know, they had fought for years and years to obtain the benefits that really are needed to ensure that people can provide for their families. You know, it's not enough to just provide a job. You need a job on which you can live and raise a family. When you go into retirement, you need a pension. You know, because Social Security isn't enough. And that's what we need in this district.
So what can you do about this?
Well, you know, Obama has set out his budget. You know, we've got some of the recovery funds that haven't come down the pipeline yet. And these are all geared toward providing jobs in the district. You know, construction projects are the quickest, most efficient way that we can get people back to work.
Lots of that needed out there.
Yes.
What about, go ahead and take this opportunity to, now, you, like I say, you're running in the primary against Anchor Patrick. Tell us what, you know, what's the difference between, you know, Ann's also a reservation girl. I mean, she's from the Apache Res. What's the difference between you guys?
Well, the difference between my opponent and I is that we have different values. You know, my opponent is a former member of Congress. She was in Congress in 2008 and lost to Paul Gosar, who, you know, certainly didn't have a background at all in policy or had ever held office before. He just, you know, was a dentist and decided to throw his name in the hat and, you know, defeated Ann.
Yeah, with Tea Party help.
The
progressives have endorsed you. Why?
Well, they've endorsed me because, you know, I am running on a platform of ensuring that we protect Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Those programs are vital to the people in this district. Large percentage of the people in our district come from middle class to lower middle class to even poor families. And I have met so many seniors who, again, you know, my husband's family is one of them. Their generation, the grandfathers, grandmothers out there, had their pensions taken away from them or wasn't even offered. And so they're living off just Social Security.
Right.
That is nothing. That is pennies.
Instead of cutting Social Security, we need to find a way to fund it better.
Right.
Because people often don't have pensions. And, you know, if you put it very simply, the problem is that middle class and lower middle class and lower income people do not have enough money, and they don't have enough money to buy things, and it's stalling out the economy. So how do we get what can we do?
Well, one thing we can do, and what's on the table right now with the budget talks going on in Congress is we've got to roll back those tax cuts that are given to the corporations and the very wealthy in this country. You know, we're talking about the top 1%.
But won't they stop having companies, and won't they just give up if we tax them as much as we're being taxed?
Well, contrary to the messaging points that are put out there, you know, there is no trickle-down effect. You know, we're not seeing the benefit of giving these large tax cuts to corporations. What many of them are doing, and certainly this goes back to the mining company that wants to, they are an example of this. Rio Tinto, which has a subsidiary called Resolution Copper that wants to open up a new copper mine in northeast Arizona. You know, they're shipping that copper out of state. It's going to be
out of the country.
You're right. It is. It's going to be shipped to Mexico.
And it's owned by a foreign corporation.
So
they don't pay the public. It's public land, and they don't pay the public hardly anything.
So
we're extracting the copper.
Are you in favor of the just do it right?
You know, no, I'm not in favor of this mine because they, for one, are not offering sustainable, livable
wages,
providing livable wages for the workers that are coming in. You know, the copper is not going to benefit, you know, us here in the United States. It's going out of country. Mm-hmm. And again, there goes jobs that really Americans could use, and certainly Arizonans. When it comes to, again, the tax breaks, you know, they're a registered foreign company. Mm-hmm. And so they're not paying any taxes here in the United States or in Arizona or even to the county level. They're using our resources. They're mm-hmm. taking up, again, all the water.
Right.
And when you look at the old mining laws that are on the books, the royalty fees that they pay to the county and the cities is nothing. It's absolutely nothing. And that's
shocking.
Why those towns are economically depressed. A lot of them have turned into ghost towns.
A copper town, when it was done to decades of mining, should be a wealthy place with decent houses, people living on pensions, an environment which was hard to clean up, but which is cleaned up, and with people looking for opportunities for their kids. Anything else you want to add? We're running out of time. What's important to you now? In if you get in this office, or when you get in office, what's the first thing you're going to do?
Well, certainly getting back to jobs, we've got to bring jobs to this particular district. We are in dire need of them. We also need to support our small business owners. They drive the economy at the local level. We've got to stand up and protect Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And we've got to hold these corporations accountable and responsible for their actions. We cannot have what we experienced in the last couple of years with the financial mess, you know, that we're having to clean up.
We noticed that J.P. Morgan Chase lost $2 billion after campaigning against being regulated and giving long speeches about how they never made mistakes and how they knew what they were doing. And they've lost $2 billion. And we don't know who they lost it to, but I guess it's somebody out there.
We're talking to Winona Benally Baldinegro. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Very good. And she's a Kayenta woman, and she's running for CD1. She's got an incredible background and an incredible story. Certainly is prepared for the task at hand. And I admire you that you're even seeking this office. So good for you.
And unlike Mike and I, she was actually born in Arizona, one of the, 35% who were actually born in the state that are here. Most of us came in from someplace else.
Well, I feel like I was born here.
Yeah, well, I would say the Army dumped you here.
My 40
and you
years.
Stayed,
my 40 years in Arizona, because I'm only 42, but no.
Yeah, I know, Mike, I know. I know. We're going to put a picture of Mike up on the internet.
Yeah, this is one. This is a guy that's got a face for radio.
Young
for sure.
Guy.
No, we don't.
Thank you, Winona, for coming in today.
Well, thank you.
And good
you
luck
for
on your race
me.
For Congress. We're really glad you're in the race. And keep speaking out and keep that idealism that brought you back here to Arizona.
Don't forget you can get this and all the other interviews on bbid.org. bbid.org.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.